New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's returning guest is BAFTA-winning film director Chris Shepherd. Welcome to the show.
Hello, nice to see you. Actually, I don't. Thinking about it, I didn't win the BAFTA. I've been nominated.
Oh,
twice,
sorry. So sorry.
I should just point that out. But a win like that is just as good as actually winning one, I think, probably.
Thank you for the correction. Apologies. We are here to talk about your graphic novel, Anfield Road, a coming-of-age story set in 1980s Liverpool. And you're also going to share three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Does that sound like what you've come on to do?
Yeah, sounds good, yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
Indeed, indeed. So let's start at the top then. Anfield Road, published by Titan.
Yeah, Titan Comics, yeah.
Titan Comics. How does a coming-of-age story set in Liverpool become a comic that is a graphic novel? That usually it's lasers and nuclear bombs and the world's at the mercy of a villain. So what? How does this kind of story become a comic? And
yeah, that's a very good question. Actually, it's it came about because originally it was I wrote a feature script.
Yeah.
And it's, as is true in true to form in the UK film industry, I couldn't get any money to make it. So then I tried to make other projects happen, and different things happened and or didn't happen. And then I sort of and then the lockdown happened, you know, just COVID and everything. And then everything sort of stopped. And then I thought, like, I'd realised that I'd be pitching on a lot of things that never happened. And and then I thought, well, I really like this story. So I thought, well, I've got an advantage over other people in that, you know, I can write a script, but I can also draw or, you know. So then I just started to draw. And I had thought about doing a graphic novel when I was I used to teach at Kingston University.
Okay.
On the illustration course. And graphic novels were quite a big, you know, like a big component of that, you know.
Yeah.
Illustration, animation, and I did think about doing it then, but I think over about 6 years I did 20 pages, or some of 5 years I did, and that was it. But when the lockdown happened, then I just really sort of sat down and went for it. I got really disciplined, and I'd be like, you know, really drawing every day, and I got really excited doing it. Really. And I suppose at times I put off doing the idea of doing a graphic novel, because when I make films, I like working with people.
Yeah.
But being a graphic, I was always a bit scared of being by myself and just sitting there drawing. But I actually really enjoyed it, you know. I thought it was great. And I think my drawing really improved. And yeah, I used to...
That's not normal, is it? In the normal comic construction, there's a writer and there's an illustrator, isn't there? They're not usually one and the same person, are they?
Well, quite often when I show people the book, they look at it and then they go, somebody says, "Did you do all that?" And I go, "Yeah, I did." Yeah. And they go, No. "You wrote the story and you drew it." I said, "Yeah, I did the lot, you know, I did everything." But I suppose because I've done both, I've written scripts, I've done animation, you know, I thought it wouldn't be a problem, but it is intense drawing though, and it does take a long time. It took me about a week to draw a page.
Oh, wow.
Depending on the complexity of it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's 272 pages long, so it took a long time. It took 4 years.
Gee whiz.
To draw it.
Famously, Alan Moore, who did things like The Watchmen, was very he didn't like his work being adapted for screen. He saw the comic or the graphic novel as its own medium and movies as a very different medium. So as somebody now who straddles the two, and this is born out of a project that started off life as a potential film, what would you say are maybe the differences or similarities that you found between making films and making a graphic novel?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One thing is I feel like, I come at it with my skill set.
Yeah.
And I think I think some graphic novelists, they play with what the page is. So if you get somebody like Chris Ware, a page can be like a puzzle. A page can be something that you work out and you break down.
Mm.
And, you know, sometimes you might have one big image of something and then you'll have a close-up of the eyes and the panel and the mouth and it's all like an illustration.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say my book's like that. I would say my book is... Some people have said to me they feel it's more filmic in the sense that you're in a reality. And I don't really bust the pages apart a lot in a way.
Okay.
There's some fantasy moments in it, but I tend to go to double page spreads. I tend to do that, but I'm not. I think maybe because I am a filmmaker, I think about the story like that.
Yeah.
But the other thing I was going to say, which is interesting, is I feel like when I the decisions I made in the when making the book were quite similar to the decisions you make when you make a film.
Okay, like what?
You know, except you're doing it in ultra slow motion, like ultra slow motion. Like if you shoot a live action film, you can go to the room, have the actors, block out the scene, and you can work through with the actors and everybody, like what happens in the scene and the motivations of the characters. But when I was doing with the book, It was really, 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 really slow. You know, I mean, like if I was, there's a sequence in a pub and it's 22 pages long. So it's 22 weeks of drawing this sequence.
Yeah.
Like months.
Yeah.
And but what would happen is as it went on, I'd think, oh, well, I don't think the character would say that. I don't think they would do this. And I'd probably come to the same conclusions I would have done if it was a film, but I've just worked through it. But they are different. I remember when I did, when I wrote the script, obviously you write a script, it's very economical for dialogue, you know, that's good dialogue is to be economical. But with the book, I ended up adding more and more text because then I started to think about, does it have a punchline on the end? Of two pages, or is the punchline at the start of the page, the end?
Does that maybe speak to one of the differences between a graphic novel and a film, where in a film you'd have that time to breathe and people could make their own interpretation, whereas if you turn the page and carry on, you're moving into a different mode, aren't you, in terms of what's happening?
Oh, yeah, well, the key difference between a graphic novel and a film is in a film, you know, as the director, you can dictate how people view your work. Uh-huh. So you show the timing, the acting, the pace, everything you give to them the way you want it.
Yeah.
But a graphic novel, you don't. You give them a book and then, you know, they can turn the pages as fast as they like, as slow as they like.
Yeah, and you can start in the middle if you want. If you just want a quick look, couldn't you?
Yeah. And I think as well, what's interesting is that I remember I drew it all in Photoshop and I spent years drawing it and all, you know, finished it. And I was very into like all the detail of it because there's a lot of detail in the book. Actual detail in the scenes and things. And but when the book came through, you know, and I got a copy of it, then I realized that the book is like an artifact in its own right. It's an object. It's not like a film. It's And when people look at my book, they go, oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful as an object.
So yeah, no one's ever said that about a PDF, have they, when they get a screenplay?
No, but it's interesting, the difference, isn't it? You know, like people, but then it's a completely different thing as well, because you're making, when you make a film, it's been, odds are, if it's commissioned, it's been paid for already. You've been paid, you've made it, and you show it. But with a book, it's like, it's something that has to be bought.
Yeah.
So what it is as a book, what the cover, how nice it looks, is a real key part as to whether or not people will look at it. So it's like a different, completely different things from a film and a book, you know.
So those people with a keen ear for accents who might recognise it, you've got a Liverpoolian accent, would see why you would write a graphic novel called Anfield Road. So what was it about your home city that inspired this story in you? First off, as a screenplay, and obviously then what become the graphic novel.
Yeah. Well, I've always, obviously, I really love Liverpool. You know, I love it. I mean, I it's such a great place. And then I growing up in a place, you know, you. With all my films, I've tried to capture elements of the city and characters. And this, I suppose, in a way, this story was like an extension of projects I'd done before, but bigger, you know? I mean, the book itself is inspired by me growing up in Anfield. But it's not a memoir, and it is fiction. It's not, you know, the events that happened in the book didn't actually happen, you know. And it's different characters. There's Connor Sterling, and he's, you know, when you look at the book, it says it's a northern fantasy, and that's how I like to see it in a way. It's like a fantasy of what could be, you know, like a different reality, really, a different set of occurrences.
A question I like to ask documentarians who go on a kind of investigative or exploratory journey about a subject that they might perceive at the start, and then maybe what they learn changes what they understood or what they perceived at the beginning. So obviously, if you grew up in Anfield and you've now written a screenplay and spent years drawing out the comic as well to become the graphic novel, how have your perceptions of Anfield changed through the experience of making this graphic novel? Because I doubt most people would spend 4 years ruminating on a story about the place they grew up.
Yeah, well, maybe it's like, maybe it's because I left. Maybe I'm you're trying to capture something, aren't you? In a way, capture that, the authenticity of the city. And then, of course, it's changed a lot, hasn't it? You know, that. So much of Liverpool, it's so different now.
Yeah,
you know, and it's that thing as well. Is I think what I wanted to do with the book was to. I always think about people like Shane Meadows, the way that they'll show like a council estate in a film, but it's really beautifully shot, and I wanted the film to be beautiful. You know, like to be like a love story, be beautiful. And be colourful, you know. So it's like a heightened reality in a way.
Yeah.
But you see, I've got romanticism for all of the destruction, because when I grew up, you know, in Anfield and Everton, you know, I it would be like there'd been slum clearance and everything was demolished and all that was left was the streets.
Yeah.
And except for the pubs. There was a few pubs, and it was just like a road layout, almost like a landscape, like Hiroshima or something, you know. And I think now, when I it must be quite alien to anybody who's young now. I've shown my son Robert. Sometimes I show him pictures of Liverpool the way it was, and he just can't believe it because it's like it's 100 years ago. Never mind 40 or something, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like to try to capture, and I got into drawing like things that are gone, and drawing buildings and old buses and TJUs and I really like doing that a lot.
I'm going to say things that people might have forgotten. Then what's some of your favourite things you've evoked for yourself, and therefore for anyone that's reading it that may be familiar with the geography of the area.
I quite like the shitty stuff, really. You know what I mean? Like, if you get at the end of the book, there's a bit in Lime Street, and it's got the Concourse Cafe, which was at the bottom of the mini skyscraper, you know, not skyscraper, but tower block.
Yeah, yeah.
The office block in front of Lime Street. And it's such a place where, you know, totally forgotten. And like the Las Vegas slot machine place next to Scullone Street.
Oh, right, I don't know.
You know, that as well. You know, but they're long gone now. They're like, they're just like echoes, aren't they, of the past? It's a bit like as well. I think the other thing is, maybe because I live in London, like when I go back, maybe I'm always in the past.
Mm.
You know, like some laughs at me when I walk down the street and say, oh, this is where I used to go busking, because I used to go busking in town and get my guitar, and I used to play Bunny Men songs and Teardrops, and I used to play Soft Cell and all kinds of things. So I used to play, and my son just goes, well, what? You know,
it's a funny part of being displaced, that, isn't it? Because I think people sometimes think that you kind of, it's always about, often people are just glad to leave, but actually you kind of leave the version of you behind, don't you? Because that's this moment in time. And nobody waits for you to come back. So obviously the world carries on, doesn't it? So therefore, you're forever comparing when you go back for your next visit to the original version of what it was you left. You're not seeing the incremental. You're going, there's another thing that's gone.
Yeah, I think I see big. It's big for me. It's big. But then I go to Liverpool now and I really enjoy it. And it's something different now. It's not like that period. It just, you know, it's something different. It's a different town. It's a different place. But I love that idea of trying to capture it. Like, there's another bit in the book where Mary's crossing the road and Connor's trying to stop her, and she says that the driver's trying to kill her.
Mm.
And says, what are you doing? And she says, it's not me, it's Ayrton Senna, as she's saying. Like, he's, you know, he's beeping her. And it's on London Road. And like, London Road's another place where I remember like going down there, you know. And it just became more and more faded as a place, London Road. And now it's really not what it was, is it?
The book's out now, and you've been sharing it to people. And you were saying to me before we started recording that you've been getting some sort of wonderful reactions from people where it's like their family or family, you know, how they remember their family being from the area, or what it evokes in them. And how have you responded to that, those kind of reactions where people are sort of, I guess, projecting their version of wherever their history stopped and something else started? But
yeah, well, it's still at the point where, because there's a few shops have sneaked it in there. And so some people have seen it and I've got in touch with me, and I've met people who've read it. And it is quite amazing now. It's like, you know, like a film. It's a big thing because it's feature length, so there's a lot in there, you know. So I think people, there's a lot you can get out of it. But certainly, people see the cover, see it, and they go, "Oh my God, Anfield!" And I've had two people yesterday say, "Oh, my granddad lived on Anfield Road," and you know, and oh, they've got to see it, and. And you know what I mean? It's I'm always like I was saying before that when I worked in the industry, when I worked in film and TV,
yeah,
I never met anybody who was from Anfield. You know, everybody was from Cambridge or Oxford or something like that. And the only people that I knew, the only people that were from Anfield I could think of, was Alison Steadman.
Mm.
And I worked with her when I did an Edna Wellthorpe project, and she was from Arkles Lane down that way, and her dad worked in Plessy's.
Wow.
She told me. And then, of course, the other person is Alexi Sale.
Yeah.
Because Alexi Sale was from the other side of the football ground from the book. And I was really thrilled because Alexi did a foreword for the book.
Okay.
Which I was really proud of because, you know, he's legend, isn't he?
Indeed. How did that come about? You just ask him or did he come?
I just asked him. Yeah, I never met him. I asked him. And then I asked him first to do an endorsement and he did it, and then the publisher said, "Oh, you've got to add 12 pages." And I thought, "Oh my God, it takes me a week to draw a page." and so I ended up doing this. It's difficult as well when you do something, you can't contextualize what it's really about. Do you know what I mean? Because you're too busy doing it. Oh yeah,
really.
Yeah, no, sometimes when you finish, I mean, you can't, like, it's hard to, you know, it's always interesting with somebody else because some more. And anyway, but I remember that I asked Alexi because I thought, well, and Alexi wrote this beautiful passage at the start of the book about how he'd travelled all over the world and been to Prague and Rome and different places. But he always came back to Anfield and that was the best. And it's a lovely way to start the book, you know, have this, it celebrates the area. It's nice.
Indeed. Well, look, thank you for sharing that about the creation of Anfield Road. Double BAFTA nominated film director, Chris Shepherd. Your debut graphic novel is called Anfield Road and it's out by Titan Comics from the 29th of October. So by the time this airs, it will be out now. Do you want to? Where will people be able to buy the graphic novel?
Well, it's for sale everywhere, really, like Amazon, Forbidden Planet in the UK, Amazon. It's also in America and Canada. You can buy it through Random House, Penguin Random House.
How exciting!
I've got a website for the book.
Yeah,
which is called AnfieldRoadStory.com.
I'll put links in the show notes so people can follow that.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
And let us move swiftly along to three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. For those that haven't heard this segment before, and for joining us because the lovely Chris Shepherd is on, Chris has given me three film titles. I am going to give Chris 5 minutes per film to talk about fond memories, why this film is important to him, what impact it had on him. And every time 5 minutes are up, we're going to hear this noise.
I remember now, yeah.
So you know what's coming, Chris. So when the 5 minutes are up, we will move swiftly along. So I'll do them in the order you gave them me. The first film in your list is 1975's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, directed by Milos Forman and written by Lawrence Hubbard and Paul Goldman. adapted from Ken Kesey's novel, and I think also Dale Wasserman's stage play, but I don't know whether the stage play came after the film or not. But do you want to tell us where One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest fits for you, why this is a film you would want to highlight as having an impact on your life?
Yeah, well, this film, yeah, I remember it's one of those films when you saw it, it changes your life.
Okay,
cool. I saw it in the Studio 123.
And where's that?
In Liverpool.
Okay.
In Liverpool. It was like in this 80s sort of block, and it was a tiny screen. I went in. And I think the thing is with the film, I think it's probably the best for me, my favorite film, you know, because it's just so funny and tragic. The acting is off the scale. It is on every level. Even just look at the frames, are like paintings, just looking at it. I love, the more times I watch it, the more I look at the background characters.
Mm.
And, the more I look at everybody, and we all know how the way the film was shot, and they shot on location, they had some of the inmates in the
film
as well.
Yeah.
But Jack Nicholson's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, I just remembered I went into the cinema, and I say it changed my life. You probably ask me why, but when I came out, I don't know, it was like a revelation that when I saw it, like, film could do something.
No, this is exactly why. What thing about this format for the podcast for me is like works of art. When you come across them, if they touch you, can make you see the world differently, can't they?
Yeah, and I think it was you. I always loved things like Steptoe and Son, things that were funny and sad. I do really believe in when you get great drama, it's funny and sad.
Mm.
You know, you want that's Light and Shade.
Yeah.
But Cuckoo's Nest is like that, you know. You're laughing with them, and laughing sometimes, maybe even laughing at them at times, and it sort of makes you question what you're looking at, you know. And it's heartbreaking, you know, the ending, and with McMurphy rails against the system, and then the chief takes his spirit away, and the chief busts out, and there's the optimism of the end is something else. It's the acting, it's incredible. I mean, and the music as well, you know, the music is amazing. Mm. I mean, I think as a movie, it just totally made me think I want to make something like that. I want to make something that's funny and, you know, hits the spot, you know, I mean.
So when you saw this film, you were already thinking about the idea that you might be a filmmaker?
I always loved films, yeah. But I hadn't really started doing it. I was always wanted to express myself. So I've tried to play in a band, and then I wanted to do live action film, but didn't know any actors. Then I ended up making animated characters.
Mm.
But I mean, I did the animation not because I wanted to do animation. I did it because it was like I just wanted to express myself. So in that sense, Cuckoo's Nest. Still, I mean, I watch it now. I watch it every so often, and it blows my mind. You know, it's so powerful, and it never diminishes. It's so well made, so brilliantly shot.
How has your attitude changed to it over the decades?
I just think I marvel at it even more.
Really?
Just get more into it over time. Yeah. As I say, I look at the background characters and I look at them all, like Cheswick and Tabers and all these. Mm. And I get something from them, you know, and I can see it differently, you know. It's a complex piece of work, you know, visually.
Mm.
And then the whole thing with Nurse Rat as well, you know, she's an amazing character. You know, is she good or bad, or is she insane? Or, you know, I could spend my whole life thinking about the moral questions that come out of that film. Oh, and I probably will.
I was going to say, Louise Fletcher, who played... Oh, there's our first bell. I'll just finish that thought. Louise Fletcher said that she didn't want to make the character completely evil, but she knew she had to play her unsympathetic. But she knew that it was a character driven by and want to do the best thing, but was sort of drunk and misguided by power. And I thought it was a really nice way of describing, because it is, it's a, she's working in care, so she's trying to do something, but you can't control a mental institution by the nature of what it is and who occupies it. Nobody is the same. They're the furthest away from widgets you're going to get, isn't it, really, in that kind of work environment.
Yeah.
Order isn't going to be what's going to solve the problem.
Yeah, my favourite line in it is when she's, McMurphy says, you're no crazier than any other asshole in this, walking the streets. This ratchet says, that's an interesting observation, Randall. Yeah.
Right then. For your second choice, we're going for a film that Bob Hoskins was nominated for an Oscar for Best Actor, but despite winning many other awards for this role, he was beaten to the Oscar by Paul Newman for his role in The Colour of Money. I'm talking, and that was Hoskins' only Oscar nomination as well. I'm talking about 1986's Mona Lisa, directed by Neil Jordan. Do you want to talk us through where this one fits in your film-watching life and how it had an impact on you?
Well, I suppose, yeah, but this one's like, I think, when you watch a film and it has a resonance with, you know, you as a person, how you grew up. And I think, I mean, I always really loved Bob Hoskins. He was like, for me, my favourite British actor.
Okay.
Because he's like feasible how he works. He's a film star, but you wouldn't believe he is to look at him. But the energy of him on screen, I always feel like he's just, like, I feel like when I watch one of his films, even though I've seen it before, something else might happen. Because it's like, he seems so spontaneous when his performances are so, like they're real, you know, he's so, but then you love him and, you know, and like, and Mona Lisa as a film, you know, You really love his character. You love it. You know, you love. But I think the thing for me was that, I mean, I have a bit. I mention it because of the book as well. There's a bit where the Danny comes to meet Connor, and I've made another film called The Ringer where I sort of about meet my dad for the first time when I was 38.
Mm.
And I think there's this sequence, there's things about the film Mona Lisa whereby, like, the scene where Bob Hoskins goes, knocks on the door where his daughter lives and his ex-wife, and then he's saying, like, you know,
yeah,
I want to see my daughter. And she's saying, get lost. Oh, dad. And I think for me, when I watched it, I'd always imagine what it would be like to meet my dad because I never met him. Oh. And I imagined it'd be like that. Would it be like Mona Lisa? So I think sometimes films can do that, can't they? Mm. It can put you in a space where, like, maybe that could happen.
Mm. You know what I mean? I remember when this film came out and the kind of moral dilemma that the mainstream, the sort of mass media had in terms of, we had to be sympathetic towards a man who's just got out of prison, who's driving a prostitute around, like as if a prostitute isn't human, which obviously we know from like documentaries we've seen about Yorkshire Ripper case and stuff, that society doesn't have the fullest view of a person that might be working in prostitution. And I think Mona Lisa taps into that, doesn't it? Because it makes us see human beings outside of what we might define them as in terms of their role.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think Kathy Tyson is awesome in it. And that scene, I always remember this scene when she's hitting him in the face with the leather strap in the room.
Mm.
And, you know, it's some really powerful scene. And the ending as well, when they're on the pier and, you know, and she doesn't, you know, he's upset that she doesn't want to know him. Or he realizes that she's got the other relationship with the girl who he's been looking for. You know, that's really powerful. I mean, you really feel for George in that film because he's really like, you know.
Well, he's a man out of time. He's a man out of time, isn't he? He's almost like a Western character, you know, in the sense of like,
yeah.
You know, in terms of the world is moving on and it won't wait for him. And obviously being in prison is like the perfect catalyst for being left behind, isn't it, in terms of society. Yeah. I don't know if you know, there's a common ground between your first film, Cuckoo's Nest, and this film. Neil Jordan cast real prostitutes in this movie.
Okay, well, yeah, it got the integrity. It feels real, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that kind of certain. I mean,
I know it was Hoskins' project, wasn't it? He was the big driving force.
Oh, was he? I didn't know that.
Is a lot going on there. It's like a thriller as well, but it's got integrity and it feels real. But again, it has comedy and humour. Mm. You know, it's funny. Like the bit where they fight and then there's the ridiculous fight on the pier.
Mm.
There's one minute where you realise that George's heart's broken and it's going, and he puts the glasses on and he says, "Do I look funny? Am I a joke? Am I a joke?" and all that. And then they see the hitman coming to get them. Then there's like tension.
Yeah.
And then it ends up with a big fight with all of circus people on the pier, and it becomes ridiculous then, doesn't it?
Yeah. When you see a lot of the gangster films that are done at the kind of lower end of sort of the film industry world, they kind of miss that survival element and the absurdity of what you're doing. It's always about the grimness and the machismo and the toxicity. But actually, nobody lives 24/7 by being an evil bastard. I mean, even the evil bastards have to have a laugh and fart and shit. You know, it's like, it isn't. And that's what I think films like this and Long Good Friday and Get Carter, they get that kind of element of, it is absurd as well as it's fun at times as well.
Well, I think it's interesting with George as well. Like, he's quite an innocent in the film, really. Mm. He's very innocent. And he's got Robbie Coltrane helping him.
Mm.
And he bounces ideas off him and he helps him know George and all that. And he's got friendship. It's like he's a really great character, George.
Mm. Indeed. Right then, we come to your final choice, which is a film that Mark Kermode listed as one of his favourites of the noughties. I'm talking about 2008's Of Time and the City, directed by Terence Davis. It feels daft asking someone that's written a graphic novel called Anfield Road why he would think this is an important film. But this documentary about Terence Davis's birthplace, Liverpool, is just a wonderful piece of art, I would go so far as to say. But what for you? What's important for this film? What, you know... None of us were kids when we saw this film, were we? So, you were seeing this not no longer living in Liverpool. So, what did it mean for you? What did the film do?
Yeah, I remember I went to see it on my birthday, and I went down into the Curzon Soho.
Okay,
and sat there and started watching it. You know, and I loved Distant Voices, Still Lives, and things. It was a great movie, Distant Voices, Still Lives. And I sat there and watched it. And then it was just when I got to the middle bit, I remember where it had lots of shots of Everton in the 70s where it was all slum clearance.
Mm.
And then they put like this amazingly lush music on it, like Mantovani, or I don't know what it, but it's absolutely beautiful.
Right.
And again, I think that what really got me with it was that he showed this through the archive footage, the way he edited the music he used. He showed the beauty of it. And I sat in the cinema, cried my eyes out, looking at it, because it took me right back. Took me right back to the growing up.
Mm.
But it was beautiful as well. You know, it was a beautiful thing. They played it in a way that was lush.
Yeah. I mean, Terence Davis is born in 1946, which is the same year as my dad. And if it had been the same day that me and you saw the film, then I was round the corner at the Panton Street Odeon watching it. And and all I could see was as if it was my dad telling me about, because he's a Catholic, grew up in Liverpool. And I just felt like I was being told, like another version of my dad's story, Liverpool. But also getting some details that I never had. Like, for example, the sort of slum clearances, the after effects of World War II still not really being cleaned up at all. The city was like you described earlier, with what you were saying about Anfield Road, is that it was just a bunch of streets that have been left behind, and nobody decided to fix them up yet. And but it didn't look like the kids were having a horrible time in the archive footage you showed. It's like they're making best of. I'm not saying that it's desirable, but they were making best of what it was.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, you made your. I mean, I remember as a kid, you could go anywhere or go climbing buildings. Everything was derelict and everything. You know, it was pretty crazy when you think about it. And it'd be a health and safety nightmare now. But yeah, that bit, particularly the bit in the middle of the film, that's the bit that really got me. And I know I've got a friend, Asian, called Kate Haldane, and she watched it, and that convinced her to go back.
Really?
To Liverpool, and she went back. And I think, ironically, she's in the same building as Sol and Roy, who produced the film.
Which amazing. Is funny. Amazing.
And but yeah, it's really fascinating that reimagining it. I think, you know, the other thing with Liverpool is, and I think that it's the same with the book and this film.
Yeah.
It was always like a legendary place that people said was amazing. You know, but you say, oh, you know, there used to be airships that used to park here, and they used to, Queen Mary used to come in, and millions of people got off. And it was always like in the 80s, it always felt like it was the echo of that, really. But I was always obsessed by the idea of before and after, and always trying to figure out like what it was in the past, you know.
Do you think that was a nostalgia for something that never existed, or a real nostalgia?
I don't know. It's just like mythology somehow. You could see elements of it, you know, when you were walking around Everton and all just half-demolished buildings. You could see how fantastic buildings were, you know, like the Anne Fowler sort of hostel on Everton Brow was really fantastic. But then you'd have the mix of like the 60s blocks and this amazing Victorian architecture all together, but all like in the States, you know, I mean, it's funny to think about now, you know. There's lots of in-jokes in the book, by the way, as well.
Go on.
I don't know whether anybody will get, but there's a few in there, all related to the past of Liverpool, you know.
Well, give us, while you've mentioned it then, give us one. Now we've finished the three films, give us one of your in-jokes then that people can look forward to.
I'm trying to think. But one that's funny is I was in this telly show when written by Willie Russell called One Summer.
Yeah, remember it well.
And I actually had a speaking role in it, but me, RJ, he got industrial compensation, so he booked a trip to New York, so he didn't want to cancel it. So I ended up not doing the speaking role, but I became an extra. So there's one bit in the book where I've written I've drawn the scene, the approximation of the scene where I was in the film. And then I put, I can't remember what I've written now. I wrote something like, I put some graffiti on the wall saying, the Swan Jacks did Icky. Because it was Billy and Icky, and it was Swan Jacks. I was a member of the Swan Jacks gang. I didn't say anything in it, but I stood next door to the leader, trying to look mean, but I'm not at all mean person. He got stabbed, Icky. So I put a little joke in. There's a little joke in there, you know.
God,
that things like that. I just did loads of little bits like that.
God, Icky got stabbed. That was heartbreaking. That as a kid, that was. I was very young when that came out. There was a Sunday evening viewing, if I remember rightly, when it was on the telly. There was that and Willie Russell, was it Day Out, was it called, or Big Day Out?
Day Out. I love that. It's so funny, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a published version of the script. It's just a joy.
But the other thing with just thinking about of Time and City and thinking about the book.
Yeah.
I think it's always that thing, isn't it? I remember when I first saw Our Day Out.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that I could see my world on the screen.
Yeah.
Because somehow growing up, it was like nobody would ever talk about Anfield. You wouldn't see the streets or, you know, it was not something that was you'd see. But I remember seeing Our Day Out and going to school, and it'd be like a sensation because everybody's saying, oh my God, did you see that last night? It was because we were all so amazed by it because it was like, reality, you know. And And I think in a way, that's what I've tried to do with the book. I tried to make it, you know, a slice of the 80s.
Indeed. Well, congratulations on your debut graphic novel. And thank you very much. Sorry, I should name it Anfield Road. And thank you very much for joining us on the BritFlix podcast.
No worries, it's a pleasure.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you're a facilities manager at a university, you know students rely on the cafeteria for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and the occasional late-night snack. So when a dishwasher breaks down and dirty plates pile up, the mess hall can turn messy in the blink of an eye. Enter Grainger. With over a million industrial-grade products and fast delivery, the product you need now is never far away. So you can turn that dishwasher back into a lean, clean washing machine. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.